Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. I am your host, Don Abernathy, and we got a wide variety of a show today. We have an interview with female living historian and equestrian superstar, Sam Dittman. And then we'll follow that up with a nice interview I did with another living historian slash educator slash former journalist and published author, Art Durkheimer, a very good friend of mine. Fantastic interview with him. But before we kick that off, I got Dave sitting here with me today.
What's happening, buddy?
I just wanted to try a little something here with you. I got
sure,
a whole
man.
List of common phrases that we use nowadays that actually have their origins from World War II.
Really?
So I want to just throw a few of the easy ones at you and see if you can guess the definition.
Okay, let's do this. This is going to be cool.
First one, off his nut.
Off his nut.
I'm sure many people have said Dave is off his
nut. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Mentally not stable.
Close enough. Means close. He's crazy.
Yeah, crazy, yeah.
Now, here's an interesting one. The fast food chain has this as its title.
Uh-oh.
And it's kind of come back into the vernacular amongst the internet people the last few years. PDQ.
PDQ. Public.
No. You want an example? Let me use it.
Yeah, use it in a sentence. Let me see. Because I know it's a restaurant.
I gave you a task, Dave. I need it done PDQ.
Pretty damn quick.
There you go.
All right.
The phrase is put on your glad rags.
Put on your glad rags?
Now, that one's not really popular now, but this was a big term back then.
All right, put on your glad rags. I'd say get your ass dressed. Get dressed.
Dressed up in your best clothing and go out on the town.
Right, okay, cool.
Here's a common one. A lot of times used with kids. Jeepers Creepers.
Jeepers Creepers. That's an incident where something's scary?
That's what we've turned it into in modern day.
Okay.
Back in the 40s, it was a swearing euphemism for saying Jesus Christ.
Oh, really?
So if you were very religious and you didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain,
right,
you'd say Jeepers Creepers instead.
Oh, wow. That makes total sense. I see that, yeah.
Now, this one has changed a little bit. You don't hear it much nowadays, but you would hear it kind of in the 70s and in the 60s.
All right.
I got to go see a man about a dog.
Oh, bro, I know this. I got to go see a man about a...
Now, another version you may have heard is I got to see a man about a horse, but this is,
yeah,
I got to see a man about a dog, and I think I got to see a man about a horse is a different connotation.
Different connotation, okay. So, I got to go see a man about... got to go pick something up.
I gotta leave now, especially to go buy liquor.
Really? No. I gotta go see a man about a dog means I gotta go get some booze?
I'm going to the liquor store, man. Yeah.
Later, bro.
Now, here's a term that I've worked into the traffic on a Stan and Haney show for a while. It's kind of died out. The word is jalopy.
Dude, I love that. When that pops in there, man, I'm like, yeah, check it out. Broken down POS, jalopy in the road, man. A piece of junk.
Yeah,
a jalopy.
Junk car.
Yep.
Now, this one is going to hurt a few ears, but we're going to say it anyhow.
All right.
Fag.
Oh, I've been in trouble for that one.
Yep.
Yeah.
But this is the 1940s definition.
Yeah, a cigarette.
And, yep, I was going to say, and it's a British definition.
Yeah,
that is
say,
what
that
the British referred to as to their cigarettes.
And I'm trying to remember, you know, obviously, yeah.
Now, I picked this one out because this one's used a lot nowadays, but I think the definition has changed a bit.
Okay.
Shiv.
Shiv, like chivalry.
No.
No?
Like you're in prison.
Oh, a shank?
A shiv.
A shiv.
Similar.
Something to pry something open with? I mean...
A shiv is a knife.
Okay.
More people, I think, when you hear that word now, especially over in the shank version,
yeah,
shank is to stab someone, but
yeah,
I think when people hear shiv now, they think of a homemade knife, primarily created while by someone in prison.
Yeah. Well, I'm also thinking, I think... That word kind of confuses me a little bit because I'm thinking of, you know, shiv and a shim. I mean, it's not that they're so close.
Well,
shim's, you know,
something you use to balance.
That's, you know, yeah.
To keep it from wobbling, like when you stick a ketchup pack underneath your
right
lunchroom table at
yeah
high school.
Your table or your front, you know, in alignment on your car.
Yeah.
Very cool, man. I like those. You know, that hasn't really changed much.
No, I mean, I got a whole list of them here. I didn't want to over inundate
yeah
you with them.
No, that's cool.
I just kind of read through them quickly and saw the ones that you may be familiar with.
Absolutely, man. Throw me one that I might not be, because I just want to see if I...
The Real McCoy.
Something that's not a generic, something that's, you know...
Close enough. Real, the real thing or genuine?
Yeah, the genuine.
Wet blanket.
Dear, come on, really? Wet blanket. A wet blanket. What do they call that stuff that knocks you out? Like chloroform? Like a wet...
No, let's go back and think more Happy Days.
Okay, a wet blanket.
His sister comes home and is upset and said, my date with Johnny sucked. He was a real wet blanket. Of course, they wouldn't use the word sucked on Happy
Days. They wouldn't use...
He was a real downer. He was a real wet blanket.
Just, I don't... Bro, tell me. I wouldn't be able to guess that one.
A person whose depression brings others down.
Oh, real... Okay, yeah.
Torpedo.
Torpedo. Now, this is what they would say in the 40s, right? And so...
Yeah, primarily... And a lot, you know, in the service and everything.
Service, military.
Now, clearly, this isn't referring to a...
Torpedo. Scuttle something.
No, scuttle is to sink something. Actually, technically, well, scuttle is a hole.
I'm thinking torpedoed it, you know.
Okay. These are more slang. Torpedo. Okay. A hired thug or killer.
Okay, yeah. Wow.
Beat
I like
your
that.
Gums.
Somebody
they
just...
would use this a lot in the Marine Corps. They would tell the young guys to stop beating their gums.
Nervous chatter.
Close enough to talk a lot about a particular topic.
Okay.
How about blow it out your barracks bag?
Blow it out your barracks bag. Okay.
Something Stan might tell you.
Yeah. Blow it out your barracks bag. Blow it out your barracks bag. Shut up.
Shut up or go to hell.
Yeah.
Here you go. Bog pocket.
Bog pocket. Somebody that's slow.
Nope. Tightwad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I went out with Jim for dinner, and I ended up paying everything. He was a real
bog pocket, man. Wow. I like these, man. We need to bring these back, bro. What's up, bog pocket?
How about carrier pigeon?
Well, the definition of carrier pigeon was...
Once again, most of these are referring to a...
It's a slang, yeah.
It's a slang for someone or...
Carrier pigeon. Somebody that... somebody that runs messages.
Correct. A serviceman acting as an officer's messenger.
Yeah, okay.
Here's one. Corn plaster commando.
Corn plaster are you serious?
I'll help you with this one. It may even make it harder. In World War I, the American infantrymen were referred to as doughboys. Actually, I just gave the answer.
Okay. Yeah,
it's referring to an infantryman.
Infantryman, okay.
Yeah,
I'm sitting here going...
Guys on the line are just covered in mud and dirt and debris.
Yep.
Devil's piano.
Devil's piano. Bad music?
A machine gun. The German's MG-42 was often referred to as the devil's buzzsaw or Hitler's buzzsaw.
Yeah.
Because of the constant firing. So the devil's piano is a machine gun.
I'll be damned.
What is French leave?
French leave?
Where'd Dave go? Oh, he's out on French leave.
He's on French leave, man. Hanging with some ladies.
AWOL. Means you went AWOL.
Well, yeah.
Other terms for AWOL, the Marine Corps used a lot was over the hill.
Yeah. Yeah, AWOL.
Landing gear.
I mean, can you use it in a sentence?
If I do, it'll give it away.
Okay.
I mean, I can't.
I feel like I'm on Jeopardy or whatever it is. Can you please, Alex, can you please, a landing gear. Somebody that's dragging.
Betty walked by. Boy, did you see the landing gears on her?
Ass.
Legs.
Ah!
Keep in mind, you know, back then, you know, below the knee was considered risque. Even going back further, my grandfather used to tell us how when he was like a kid, back in the early 30s, whatnot, they would go down to the train stations just to watch the women get on because they would see them lift up their skirts and get to see 3 inches of an ankle. And it was a jolly for them to see these beautiful women's ankles because they usually wore long dresses.
Yeah, yeah. That makes total sense.
Now, this one's easy for anybody who follows anything in World War II. Mae West.
Mae West, a hot lady.
That's referring to the life jackets because of the way they hung down, they look like boobs.
Really?
Mae West was a famous actress back then.
Yeah, I mean, I know that. That's what I was thinking.
We'll do one more. I don't want to bore everybody here.
No, these are pretty cool. In fact, I like them, man. I think it's pretty neat.
What's a sugar report?
A sugar report. I would say that would be...
Did you see the smile on Dave's face today? He got a sugar report.
Telling somebody that they did a good job?
A letter from your sweetheart. That's enough of the beating of the gums for today, to use our word of the day.
Yeah.
So we've been beating our gums here. We're going to get on with the interviews. And today we're trying something new again. We're breaking a lot of ground over here. Today we're doing our first interview via Facebook Messenger, because cell phone service sucks in certain parts of Florida. And today I have another reenactor / horse riding phenomenon. A friend of mine, we did an event together a few months back down in Naples. That event is probably the closest thing I have to a backyard event. Joining us today is Miss Sam Dittman. Hey Sam, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Fantastic. Just another Saturday, hanging out, doing what we do. So, let's get started. Well, let's get started at the beginning. What got you into historical reenacting? Now, I know you do World War II, but you also do other impressions and other eras.
I do.
Let's just start there. Let's start how you got into it. And I'm really interested in finding out how you got into the equestrian world as well.
It honestly kind of goes hand in hand. Actually, let me start at the beginning. My dad is an aircraft mechanic, so I've grown up around airplanes and aircraft, and I spent a lot of my childhood at the airport.
Okay.
And a lot of the guys who had airplanes near us, like our hangar neighbors, they were all either pilots, mechanics, or trained the guys who flew in World War II. So that is what piqued my interest in World War II, and especially the aircraft of World War II.
So was he a private mechanic, or was he a military mechanic?
He's a private mechanic.
Did he work primarily on jetliners or small or just about everything?
Mostly general aviation, but he's worked on everything. He's done rotorcraft, jet, pretty, you name it, he's worked on it.
So your early exposure led your interest, well, not only early exposure to airplanes and aircraft, but to, as you just said, some of the World War II veterans. How old were you, and what was the first event you got involved with?
Well, I've grown up with it. My event that's near and dear to my heart is Sun and Fun. Okay. That's what I grew up going to. And back when I was little, it was an EAA fly-in, which in the general aviation world, it's actually made up of a lot of veterans. So that is the crowd that I grew up around from the womb, actually, because my mom camped at Sun and Fun while she was pregnant with me. So it's been since then.
I think I attended Sun and Fun about 2 years ago. That's not in Stewart, because that's a Stewart Air Show. Where is Sun and Fun at? I can't remember.
It's Lakeland, but Lakeland. Now it's run by the Sun and Fun Corporation, so it's more of a commercial air show and expo now instead of an EAA fly-in, which it used to be.
And for a lot of those who aren't familiar with this event, like I said, I went to it one. It's kind of cool. It's not like your normal air show where a group hires in some stunt flyers, which there are. It's like the stunt flyers plus kind of like a car show. Pilots actually fly their own planes in for the weekend, set up their planes, and camp out at the airport, much like you would do at a classic car show. And that's one of the unique things about that event. When I was there about 2 years ago, I was doing my Marine Corps impression with Mike Blosky and his crew. And that was the weekend he premiered his Jeep that he rebuilt. But that is a great show.
It's the second largest air show in the country. And like you said, it's also a fly-in. So you have people who camp. You have people who fly in from all over the country and all over the world to this event, because not only is it the second largest in the United States, it's also one of the largest air shows in the world. But besides that, you have commercial vendors who come and set up, and it's, like you said, it's like a car show. So you'll have like the people who bring their classic vehicles in, but you also have all the vendors showing off all their new models and the new stuff coming out this year.
And I would assume there's some sort of swap meet where you might be able, if you're trying to rebuild an older plane or classic plane, you might be able to find that hard-to-find part there as well without having to deal with shipping and handling from ordering on the internet.
Yeah, it's a big it used to be a hangar, and then it was a tent, and now it's in a building. But it's just everyone who comes to the event brings their stuff. Engines, airframes, instruments, whatever, exhaust pipes. I've actually bought some of my reenacting clothes there too. Models, books, whatever. There's all sorts of aviation related stuff there.
Now, I think that the majority of the events that I've attended with you, you've primarily done French Resistance. Is that correct?
Yes, I have.
What are your, is that the primary World War II impression you do other than civilian? Because I've seen you in some of your events and some of the photos, like a VKE, for example. I've seen you do French Resistance, and I've also seen you do French civilian. I mean, are those your two primary World War II impressions?
They're my primary impression for anything with a public battle, because I don't want to sit on the sidelines. I want to go and play with the boys. Well, I want to get out there and I want to shoot my rifle.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to bring up. It's a smart move on your part, because you, unfortunately, the roles that women played during the war, when you're involved in reenacting as a female, you're either going to do whack, you're going to do a nurse or a civilian, or as you figured out, you can do French Resistance, get your rifle and go out there and actually get dirty and participate, fire the rifles.
Yeah.
Out of all the events we do here in Florida, my personal favorite is VKE. I've attended it twice, and that's probably, I believe, the first place you and I met. And that's,
I believe so.
That's another one with Resistance, but my favorite part about that event is you co-mingle with the public. Most of these events, we're out in the field, people are behind a barrier, and they're just watching us like, you know, like an event, whereas VKE, they're on the train, they're participating, we're interacting with them, we're handing out paraphernalia and stuff, and they're part of the storyline, and that's one of the reasons that's my favorite event, because you actually get to engage more, not only just showing off your toys, but you get to pretend they're there with you, and it really brings them into it.
Yeah, I also really, really like that event, because like you said, it's more of, I guess, a full immersion kind of event, because you have to be in character the whole time. It's not like, okay, I'm going to go out to the public battle, or, oh, there's someone at my table, I'm going to talk to them. It's, you are in the moment the whole time, which I love.
And that's one of the hardest things, like, when I did Sun and Fun, the reason I knew so little about it is because when you're there and you have your gear out, your tent set up, you're in uniform, yeah, you can wander off a few times to get some food, maybe look at some of the displays that are local to your stuff, but you really don't want to leave your stuff alone and unprotected, and you really don't want to put your stuff in someone else's guard for too long, because that becomes a hassle to them. And so that's kind of the downside about when we do these really cool events, especially these large ones. Like, I'm doing Mount Dora at the end of the week, at the end of the month, and that's a huge antique show plus military stuff plus reenacting. And I'm trying to figure out how I can get away from our bivouac long enough to actually experience and enjoy that event as well.
Yeah, that is hard. So a lot of times I don't bring a whole lot to my display because, like you said, I don't want to be like, hey, watch my stuff. I'm going to go and check everything out while you have to stay here.
Well, as I alluded to in the beginning of this conversation, you're in the equestrian world, and when you do your other impressions, you have a living, breathing part of your display. You bring your horse to a lot of these events.
I do, yes. With my horses, I do a conquistador impression, because the breed of horse that I have and show and display is a Florida Cracker horse, and these horses are direct descendants of the horses the Spanish brought over in the 1500s. So it's a really cool draw, just like with the tanks or the airplanes, that people can see a living piece of history.
Yeah, but you have it harder than we do, because with our displays, even with the tanks, we're in full control of them. Whereas I've met your horse, it's a beautiful animal and it's well behaved, but let's be honest, an animal is an animal, a horse is a horse, a crowd is a crowd, and sometimes people can be, let's just say, not aware of how to interact with a large animal such as that. And so that takes a lot of trust on your part, knowing that you and your animal will not potentially get into physical contact with somebody who's not watching or paying attention. I mean, I've seen your horse walk through these campgrounds, walk around people, and the animal is just beautiful, and he's so well behaved. But once again, that takes a lot of effort, because you got to trust that your animal is not going to freak out around the gunfire, around crowds, around kids who aren't, once again, familiar with being around large horses and potentially getting themselves hurt.
It takes a lot of work and a lot of patience, but mostly it's just knowing your horse. Because, yes, they can be like giant little kids at some time, like at some point. But at the end of the day, when he's out there, he knows he's doing his job and he's professional. But it takes a lot of working with him and knowing how he's going to react to those things. So that way, if something does happen, if someone pushes a stroller into him or a cannon goes off, I know how he's going to react to that.
And you are such a fine equestrian and a great handler of horses, not only do you do these events, but I know back in 2016 you went on a tour with a certain group. You want to give some information on that?
Yes, the summer of 2016 I toured with the Herman's Royal Lipizzan Stallions, which was an awesome experience.
Now, when I heard about that, I didn't know too much about it, so I went to my friend Stan, who grew up on a horse farm, and his father used to rent out their farms to board horses. And when I told him you were a part of that, he basically said that is the pinnacle of horseback riding. That is not just your normal equestrian jumping horses and doing, you know, ring work. That is a tremendous amount of work. I guess you guys do synchronization, you do certain routines and things of that nature.
Yeah, we'll do like a two horse routine, or a pas de trois, which is a three horse routine, and we do a quadrille at the end. But the main thing that people come to see for is the airs above the grounds, which is the pinnacle of classical dressage. They don't even do this in the Olympics. They do some movements of the high school dressage, which like the pee-off and the passage we'll see in the Olympics. But the airs above the grounds they were developed for combat, and where what the rider does is he lifts the horse up into the air to combat ground troops.
And these just aren't normal, you know, stallions. They're all white, correct? Are they as large as a Clydesdale? A little bit smaller. Now, Clydesdales are obviously working horses. They're bred to pull large objects, and so I know the Lipizzans aren't as, let's say, round and broad, but these are not your normal smaller size horses, correct?
Well, actually, they are riding size horses. The average size is 15.2 hands, and a hand is about 4 inches. So they're about your average riding size. But one, these horses are stallions. Two, they're performers. And three, they are athletes. So when they go out into that ring, they puff themselves up and they have so much presence that they look massive, but they're not. And the reason they are that size is because the breed was created in the 1600s. So people weren't as tall as they are now. But you also want a horse that is the right for your size. So when you bring this horse into combat, you're not like, you don't look like a little kid on a Clydesdale.
Sure, you want to have that presence of being large and you know, intimidating. Not, well, here comes a big horse, a little guy on it, or a little woman on it.
Yes, and you want to be the right size for your horse, so that way you can cue him properly. Because these moves are so complicated and difficult to do, your horse needs, and especially in a combat situation, your horse needs to know what he needs to do right now.
Well, and with that certain tour and that certain performance, pageantry makes up a huge part of that. I mean, there's matching uniforms or synchronization, and I mean, it's a huge spectacle, and that's why it's a tour and not just, you know, something you could do on a weekend. I mean, how many riders were on that tour? How many horses did you guys have?
We had 12 and a half, because we had 11 Lipizzans and one Shetland pony.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like a pack mule or something.
No, the owner's granddaughter's pony. So we brought Willie with us. And then we had, let me think, Gabby, Rebecca, me, Robinson, Alexis. So we had 5 riders in the quadrille. And we all ride throughout the show, but we all have different skills and abilities because we're not exactly the same as the Spanish Riding School in Vienna, but we work off the same principles. So each girl has one or two stallions assigned to her that she works with. So I had two, and I rode Max in 2 routines and Antares in another routine, because Antares was one of the heirs' horses, so I would take him out and get him warmed up so that way he can go out and he can rear up, his muscles are limber, and then he can jump and leap and do leaps into the air.
How many shows was this tour? Was it regional? Was it nationwide? Was it statewide?
It was mostly regional. We went up to New England, and then we would do 3 shows a week. We'd do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then pack up Monday, go to the next town, and then start all over the next week.
How long did the tour last?
3 months. We left in the end, very end of June, and we came back in September, so the full months of July, August, and September, because we came back like the last week of September.
How does the I don't want to say training. How does the audition practice go for? I mean, how do they know about you and your skill set? Do you audition? Do they hear about you through competitions you performed in? Does somebody pass your name along to them? Did you see a website where they're saying, hey, we're looking for writers? How did that whole thing go down?
Well, they are located in Myakka City, and I live in Bradenton, so they live about 20 miles from me. And I had been going to their shows ever since I was a little girl, like 4 or 5 years old. So I've always gone out there and seen them, and I'm like, wow, it'd be such an amazing opportunity to ride one of these horses, much less even go on tour with them. I was like, there's no way. I'm not that good of a rider. There's no way. But a friend of mine bought me a lesson, because occasionally they will offer lessons when they're not on tour. And so we went out for a lesson, and Gabby, the woman who owns the ranch, we talked, and then we got our horse tacked up, and well, our stallion. Then she watched me ride, and we went through the lesson, and then after the lesson, she offered me a job.
Wow, that's a real quick turnaround.
Yeah.
I bet that was probably a dream come true for you, right?
It was. I'm like, are you serious? Are you playing a joke on me?
That's awesome. I'm going to redirect just because of the theme of our podcast is World War II, and trust me, I love this conversation. I'm sure there's some people saying, hey, Dick,
let's... I can connect Lipizzans to World War II.
Please do.
Okay. Well, during the war, most people don't know, but the Germans mostly used horses and trains to move their stuff, their tanks, everything.
Yeah,
their
weren't...
troops.
Most of their motorization was in the Navy and in the air.
Yes, and there's actually a few SS units that were mounted. So, throughout German-controlled Europe, they had all of these remount depots, which had all these horses. And Hitler, being Hitler, he's like, you know, we want this Aryan race. We also want a master horse breed. So he went to the stud at Piber, which is where all the Lipizzan stallions are born, and he stole the mares and all the foal stock.
Wow.
And so he took all of those and took them away, and they ended up in Hostow. And Patton's Third Army was on their way over there, and we had some guys go out on a scouting mission, and they ended up capturing a German officer. I don't remember if he was a major or a colonel, but when they brought him back to headquarters, he was very concerned about the welfare of these horses because they are such a historic breed for his country, because he was Austrian. And it has such an integral part of Austrian history that he wanted them to be saved. And lucky for him that he ended up with Patton's Third Army, because Patton is a well-known horseman.
Correct. That's why he wore the lovely boots.
Yes. So when Patton was in Vienna, Colonel Podhaski, he was in charge of the riding school at that time, put on the first public exhibition of the Lipizzan stallions, because before that point, they were only used by generals and nobility. So it's not like the public could just go to the riding school and see these horses. And Patton decided that at that point that we are going to protect these horses, and we're going to make them wards of the United States. So then, back over in Hostow, we were able to take our guys and capture the remount depot and liberate the horses before the Russians showed up. Because the Russians also wanted that remount depot, but for a completely different reason.
Oh, absolutely.
They were really hungry.
Well, I mean, yes, they're really hungry. And the Russians being the Russians, they would have easily used the horses that weren't consumed for working duties as war horses. And, I mean, let's be honest. The Russians were horrible. They weren't much better than the Nazis, but we needed them as cannon fodder. I mean, that's why we had the Lend-Lease program. That's why we're so happy to give them Sherman tanks, Thompson submachine guns, and weaponry, and helmets and clothing. Let them go, you know, let them go to battle while back at home we still had our We still had the people who were still burnt out from World War I who wanted us to not get involved. So that's why we didn't get involved until Pearl Harbor. And Patton himself, you know, once Berlin was captured, he wanted to just ride on into Moscow and just get this nonsense over with, you know, once and for all. But you know, we stuck to our agreement with them, and so that didn't happen. So, no, it doesn't surprise me that the Russians had bad intentions for those horses. And once again, let's be honest, back then, a large majority of our military were farm boys. Yes, you had a lot of city folk, but just the makeup of the nation at that point, the cities weren't as... We didn't have the suburban sprawl that we do nowadays. And so a lot of our guys who were in those units, they had grown up on farms and they worked with horses themselves. And I'm sure they had no problem getting a group of guys who were more than happy to go help liberate those horses and take care of them.
Exactly, and that's exactly what happened. It was called Operation Cowboy, and you had these guys who took the mares or geldings, because it wasn't just the Lipizzan mares and full stock. There was Arabians and Thoroughbreds, and it was Remount Depot. And so they got up on those horses and they drove them for 3 or 4 days until they were securely within the American lines and they could feed them and take care of them and house them.
And then I'm sure at some point we set up some military, you know, controlled stables and housing for them.
We did have horses, mostly mules and donkeys, in the European theater, so they probably brought them to one of our military stables that we had set up.
Now, as a young lady in modern-day America, now you've been doing this a long time, and one of the questions I like to ask, because I'm still relatively new to the whole reenacting community, I've been doing it for about 7 years, but one of the things I have a theory on, and you could probably help me with this because you've been doing it for so long, the social stigma involved with reenacting, we're all aware of it. We all know that the general public kind of think we're just dorks out there, you know, romanticizing war. But my theory is, with the exception, with the new, I don't want to say embrace, but, or the ever-growing popularity of cosplay and the comic book conventions, and more people accepting the fact that people go out and dress up as comic book characters and Star Wars characters, I think it's probably a little easier now to be a World War II reenactor opposed to 8 years ago before, you know, people start to get used to seeing photos online of people doing cosplay and things of that nature. Would you agree, or was it always, have you noticed a difference?
I would say I've noticed a difference. I remember when I was younger, a lot of people would be like, you'd get weird looks. I mean, you still get weird looks now.
Oh, absolutely.
But not like it was. And people are like, why are you dressed up like that? It's not so much with World War II, but like if you're doing Conquistador.
Yeah, you show up at a BP to fill up your truck and you got your outfit on, you get some weird looks.
Yeah. But nowadays, it's especially with World War II, because I can go out dressed as a civilian and nobody would look twice at me.
Yeah, a lot of times when I go to events, I try to, especially now that through the group I'm with, I've gotten promoted, I try to at least not have my blouse on while I'm out in public, because sadly, most of the general public, they don't realize there's a difference between a modern-day military uniform and one from 72 years ago. And I don't want to be put in a position when they thank me for my service to stop and explain that, no, I'm a World War II reenactor. Thanks for your offering of thanks for my service, but I never served. And so I've just found it's easier just not to have the uniform on unless I'm running, you know, I'll have the boots and the pants and all that on, but I usually just try to have my t-shirt on just because I don't want people to think I'm trying to do stolen valor, which clearly we're not. And once again, we're historians, we're doing something from 72 years ago, but sadly, people don't know the difference between those uniforms and the modern ones.
Definitely. I know a lot of the guys, like when we've gone out to dinner or just been in public getting fuel or whatever, that they've gone through that, and you can just tell that they're not comfortable with that, and I wish the public were made more aware of what our modern uniforms look like than our historical ones.
Well, that's going to get a little harder, because I'm sure, as you're aware, the Army is toying with bringing back the brown and pinks for their Class A uniforms.
I noticed that. I mean, I like the pinks and greens, but again, it would cause a lot of confusion with the World War II pinks and greens.
Yeah, with the general public, but I would love to see them return in those uniforms. It makes for a better photo
than seeing
a general in his ACUs, you know, it's just kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
So, since you specialize in the French Resistance, and part of being a reenactor and going to these events is you have to be able to regurgitate at least some history of what you're doing and who you're reenacting. So if you wouldn't mind, maybe just give us one of your favorite tales or inform us just What was the key role? How did the French resistance really help the Allies as we were recapturing France?
Well, my favorite analogy of explaining the French resistance is with the movie Red Dawn, because they're acting as a partisan unit. They're on their home turf, and they're doing the best they can to defend it given the situation that they're in, which is essentially what was going on in France during World War II. They had the Nazis come into France, and the French government just rolled over. But that wasn't the hearts of the people. A lot of the French citizens were not okay with that, and they were going to do whatever it took to defend their land from the Nazis.
For those of you sitting at home, you got to realize these are just farmers. These are just city people, and they're lucky to have a bolt-action rifle and some homemade explosives, whether it's their equivalent of a Molotov cocktail or anything, booby traps. They're literally going against the effing German army. The effing German army. I can't talk tonight. But they're going up against the German army with basically hunting rifles, shotguns, and whatever they can muster. But they had the advantage that they knew the land. They knew the cities. They knew where the choke points were. They knew how to set up sabotage. They knew where the phone lines were. They knew how to sabotage the railroads. And they literally helped slow the movement down of the German troops. And they helped us when the Allies came, saying, hey, you need to get to this point. Let us show you the quickest way. Those maps you have probably aren't going to be the best route. You know, break off some small squads and we can get them there quicker to help, you know, help get to your point until the rest of your men could come up.
Exactly. And a lot of times they can't really fight the Germans, like, with their rifles. But because they knew the land and because the Germans like to use the railways so much, one of the things they would do is they would either booby trap the railways or just pull out the railroad spikes so that when the train goes across, the rails fall out from underneath it. A lot of kind of Dukes of Hazzard kind of stuff. There's a scene in Band of Brothers when they're going through the town in Holland that they're talking to, I guess, Holland resistance, but it's the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
They are talking about how they've seen the German troop movement. They're telling them what bridges are coming up, where they need to be, what they need to look out for. And that was pretty much the same whether you're in France or Belgium or Holland. Wherever there was a resistance movement, that's pretty much what was going on.
And that was such a great scene because Dick Winters looked at him and said, well, where'd your intelligence come from? And he pointed over to like a 9-year-old kid, and Dick Winters looked at him and looked back at the resistance fighter, and the resistance fighter looked at Dick Winters and said, the intelligence is good. And that's all it took.
Yeah. And that's one thing about, especially in France, all of the men were off at war, so most of your resistance fighters were either women or children, which made them a lot easier to blend into the crowd, because the Germans, being the proud Germans they are not going to think that a little kid or a female is going to be the ones who are going to come after them and cause all this trouble.
Well, that, and one of the great things we did leading up to D-Day, to throw the Germans off of our landing, where we're going to land in Normandy, we actually sent out incorrect information to the French resistance so they could leak it to the Germans, saying that we were going to land further up north, and then that's where we put our inflatable tanks and basically put our invisible army. And at that point, Patton once again had pissed off the higher-ups and the brass, and so they said, well, we'll send Patton up there, so that when he gets to town, all the local reporters will see that Patton's in town, and that'll help bolster and make the ruse that we're trying to pull off more believable. And it worked. That is why we were able to invade Normandy, I don't want to say easily, but without such a resistance from the German artillery and the German armor, because they were up north expecting us to land higher up north based on the incorrect information that we had released through the French resistance to feed up the chain of the command.
Exactly. And also another thing we did right leading up to D-Day.
Hold on a second, your phone's breaking up.
Okay. I am moving right now, so I'm going to head back to my house, but we'll see if it stays.
I'm losing you. Yeah, I lost you. Wolf? We got 38 minutes out of a Facebook instant messenger interview, so that wasn't too bad. I did notice during that interview that my microphone does have a weird sound to it. One of the things I noticed is if you talk in this side, it has a different compression. And if you talk in this side, it has a different compression. And so I really have to be, well, static when talking into this microphone, which is really hard because when you work in radio like we do and you spend 4 hours a day in front of a microphone, to be static and not move is really hard to do. And so you really, you kind of lean a little bit. But with these microphones, there's definitely a sound difference. And so that's all more reason for future episodes. I'm going to have to try to invest